This is May 4th in the year 2001, and this is Bob Gilgore interviewing Martha Barbee at her home at 106 North Elliott Road.
Mm-hmm.
Good morning, Martha.
Good morning, Bob.
How are you this morning?
Oh, I'm doing.
Well, I hope you're doing well.
Mm-hmm.
The first question I'll ask you is, what was it like growing up in Chapel Hill? And when did you grow up in Chapel Hill?
Well, I was born here in the 30s. And it was a whole different time back then. There were hard times, I suppose, but there were happy times, too. Of course, we had segregation. Then I grew up in Carver. There were on Main Street in Carver, right in between where I lived in a home, two-story house with my grandparents and my mother family. Right in between where the art center
mm-hmm.
and the bicycle shop was located.
Oh,
yes.
I know the area well.
Right, and there were homes all up and down the street owned by blacks. And my grandfather was very well known in Chapel Hill, Allison Norwood. And it was a little strange for me because my grandmother was mulatto. And I guess you know that means, what is it, mixed blooded. She was part Cherokee, part white. And she looked like the whitest person I'd ever seen. And here we were living on Main Street in Carver, and my father was very dark and bald, and I thought that he was black, and that my grandmother was white. And back during those days, it was like, oh my God, an integrated couple living right on Main Street, and it baffled me that that the people, everyone treated them so wonderful. They called him Uncle Allison and my grandmother Aunt Mary. And she washed clothes.
And she was almost white.
She looked whiter than any person I'd ever seen, with long black hair. And of course back then, young people, we couldn't ask questions, Grandma, are you white? Granddad, are you black? But for many, many years I sat there and shivered, thinking about all the horrors that were going on. The Klan was active.
How was she accepted in the black community if she looked almost white?
Well, years later, as I talked to people, I found out they were looked at as not like persons of color, but Indians, I believe, you know, because my grandfather worked for Collier Cobb and Associates. And he was very outspoken in the community and everything. A lot of people said that I remind them a lot of him, you know. And he loved people, and he was a man of his word. And back then, your word was your word. Oh, yes, and hardworking. And I loved him. He was one of my mentors. I loved him. And we had, we didn't have a lot of money, but my God, vegetables, we had a beautiful garden, you know, and all that. And everybody sort of knew everybody. The white, the black community, this was in Carver, even in Chapel Hill. You didn't feel, how can I put that? Our parents taught us, grandparents, neighbors, all of our neighbors' parents were our parents, you see. We all looked out for each other, and we felt pretty much secure. Growing up, we we had our friends and our teachers. Oh boy, they were tremendous. I mean, they were just, I don't know what word to say for them. They worked diligently outside of the school and inside the school. And I just don't know how to explain it. Of course, we didn't have cars. We didn't have all the special things that the young people had today. But we had something then that was like we all were family. Oh, we had little fights and things. And I remember when I was attending Orange County Training School, I think we in Carver, we had to walk to school, and Robba then walk all the way down Rosemere and make a turn on Church Street. We would take a shortcut down Graham Street and walk through, you know, and we would get to the bottom of the hill and look up, and there was the school. And
you had to cross the creek there?
Yeah, there was a little creek there, a little bridge, and we would cross that and had to climb that hill, rain, snow, whatever, whatever. And I until this day, I don't know what happened to that hill. Everyone has been trying to explain to me what happened to it, but I still don't understand what happened to that hill. But it
you mean
was,
it's gone?
Well, everything is level now. You know, there was a hill. Maybe because I was smaller or shorter. But still, no, the climbing that we had to do, you know, but anyway, with landscaping and all that.
There were no paths? There were no sidewalks, no streets.
We just had to walk up that hill. Now, if we had gone down Rosemary to Church Street and walked down, there was a sidewalk. You understand?
Uh-huh.
But it took so long when you could take a shortcut. Going down Graham Street, and then there were, after you got to the end of Graham Street, there was a path from there through. There were log cabins then, authentic log cabins all through there, you know, and so the shortcut was easier, but the thing was, if the kids got angry with each other and wanted to sort of sock it out with each other, they would wait until they got across the branch, which was not on school property. And I think a lot of us now remember a lot of scuffles that happened there, you know, once they got off the school property. But there was no weapons, really. You know, it was just settling your little grievance or whatever. But this was Orange County Training School. And we had a big gymtorium.
I want to go back to that hill before we talk about the
mm-hmm.
gymtorium. That hill's filled with bushes and trees now. Was it that way when you were growing up and you had to climb
it? No, it was just a red and muddy. I remember being a red and muddy like hill, you know, especially when it rained, you know.
So well, what happened when it rained?
Well, it was just muddy and whatever, and we climbed the hill and we went to school, you know. You could hear the bell ringing from down below.
You must have gotten mud all over yourselves.
Well, I don't remember. We couldn't wear pants to school. We had to always wear dresses, and where now the young kids can wear anything. And the only time you wore pants is when, like if you were in the band or you had to, you know, go participate in something where you needed to wear pants. But all the female, you know, students had to wear dresses. I remember that. And I remember so many years climbing that hill. Because I was late a lot. And I always remember hearing that bell ring when I was at the bottom of the hill and trying to get up that hill to get into class. You know, before I was missed. And I remember Mr. McDougall was my principal for 12 years. I had to go into the office one day, I'll never forget that, because I was late for class. And I said to him, sincerely, not out of disrespect or trying to be sarcastic or anything, I just said, crying with tears in my eyes, I said, "Well, Mr. McDougall, it's better to be late than not come at all, not be here at all." And oh, why did I say that? He took his belt out and I had to, I think they had a, I don't know whether it was his belt or a paddle, you know,
mm-hmm.
and you'd have to hold your hand out And I was so embarrassed because people were walking by, you know, and he gave me two flecks there in the hand. But the thing was, it was that he wanted us to be the best that we could be. I loved that man. And I remember when I was a member of the Rainbow Coalition, when Jesse Jackson was running for president, I was honored to be able to present him with a plaque at Chapel Hill High School. It was called the Rainbow Coalition Award, you know, for service in the community. And now, of course, we have a C.A. MacDougall Middle School, you know, and all that. But times were hard, and we didn't have that much, but no one was poor. You know, you understand, we didn't have a lot of things and all, but, and church was the focal point, you know. I mean, that's what it was all about, getting to Sunday school, getting to church, BTU,
What's
school,
BTU?
That was Baptist training, in the evening in churches, and people walked. There wasn't, it's sad for the young people today because we didn't have to deal with a lot of the pressures that they have, you know, they have to deal with. Now, with the discrimination part, of course we had to go into back doors of restaurants. We had to, I know there was a place in Carver that saw all the best hamburgers that you'd ever want to eat. And I remember many times knocking on that back door and getting hamburgers. And just like Esper Forrest and I were talking, we knew our place. So for us, it was something we were like programmed to do. We knew our place. We knew what we could do and what we could not do. Ironic enough, I still have dreams about Carver. Most of my friends lived in Carver, and so I didn't really get to know very well a lot of the kids who live in Chapel Hill, you know, because you didn't have cars to travel all over the place and everything. But we were all very bonded together. Studious, yes, I think my class, oh boy, we were something else, you know. But we enjoyed going to school. We felt safe. We felt protected. We felt that getting good grades was something our parents didn't have to push us into doing. You know, we wanted to achieve. And a lot of the bad stuff that was going on was sort of scary. Every now and then there would be a little thing where if you go out walking at night, you had to go in groups, especially walking through Carver. And I had friends, classmates that lived in Carver, the Hogan family, and my sister, the Clarks, and all of those. And we didn't understand how they could live surrounded by whites, you know, and found out later, well, there was a stir to that, too, you might hear about, that property. They lived there. Well, it's another story there. But I guess mentally we had no choice but to accept. We couldn't challenge. There was no law. You understand, we had to just accept it, so we made the best out of it. It's very hard to explain. It's just like being conditioned, you know, being conditioned. But there were a lot of my mother, my grandmother, and my mom. They didn't have laundromats, washing machines. And so my grandmother, my mother, would wash clothes for white persons, you know, to earn money. There was not that many jobs out there because we didn't have that much of a university here then. Of course, my uncles and my cousins worked there at the university. And one of my uncles worked there 60 years. He retired and then went to Granville's Hollow, you should know that. And we didn't have the hospital, you know, so there were not that many jobs. I did a lot of babysitting. And I know I'm jumping around a lot, but I'm just trying to hit on, when I think back, it was a scary time, but then it wasn't.
What was scary about it?
Well, I just remember one incident that happened. I don't remember how old I was, but I know there was talk that persons were not able to get permits to repair their houses, you know, on Main Street. And I remember an occasion where my uncle had a hammer and nails and was trying to repair a step, because when you stepped on it, you could flip, you know, and he didn't want anyone to fall. And he just had the hammer and the nails there, and he said, and this big, and I was small then, this big policeman walked in the yard and said, "Mr. Norwood, you don't have a permit. You know, do you have a permit to do this?" And I didn't understand. He said, I just have a hammer and nails. I'm just trying to repair this step. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
Also.
So did he stop him from doing the
repair? Oh, no. He continued doing it. But one thing that that really I remember so deeply is that after World War II was over, and both my uncles served in World War II, one of my uncles, they are all deceased now, they're the elders in the family now, came back after World War II was over, and he did a lot of, I was very young then, he did a lot of, he was on the ocean a lot, you know, World War II, and he had to do night duty a lot and all that, and I think he did see more activity than my other uncle. He got as far as California, and they would get mad to ship them over when the war ended. But my Uncle Jeff actually saw devastation, you know, a lot of things. So when he came home, when they got home, they were so excited. And he and my Uncle Frank went down to Chapel Hill, and they had a bar there. And they walked inside and said, "We want to order a beer." And the bartender looked at them, and he was older. He was too old to go into service, you know. And he looked at them and said, "We don't serve Negroes here." And my Uncle Jeff, just, he's very quiet, but he just went bananas. He said, "No." He said, "You will serve me. I've just risked my life, you know what I mean, and spent X amount of years making sure that people here were protected. And then I come back to my hometown, and you're going to tell me, you know what I mean?" He said, "You will serve me." And they refused to get up. And so I was told that he said that because everyone knew my grandfather, and they respected him, and so Allison Norwood's son. So they served him. And my uncle came home, and the next day he told my grandparents that he couldn't live here in the South. He said, because after what he had experienced, and surely, you know, you think about it, I can understand, after all he had experienced when he was overseas, he could not tolerate that type of mentality here. So he left a few weeks later and moved to Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, and worked on the railroad. And I had another, my grandmother's sister and brother moved to Massachusetts. But you know, That right there, I was proud of the way he challenged that, you know, but I hated, I loved him. I hated that he had to leave, you know, but he said if he stayed here, he would probably end up hurting someone because he just couldn't handle that, you know.
Did they serve him?
Oh, yes, they did. They served him, because they knew my grandfather. See, everybody black and white knew each other, you know, so. And one person I'd like to give special credit to back then was Dr. Lord. I guess you may have heard about him.
Dr. Lord?
Lord, yeah.
Lord.
He was a white doctor, had an office. He worked out of his home right down below Wendy's and Harbor. What's that street, man? So changed out there, man. And he always let everyone come in his front door. And he took care of. He took care of all of the. You want to stop doing this because he treated everyone equally. You didn't have to go in his back door. And he sort of reminded you of the doctor in the movie Gunsmoke.
Mm-hmm.
With the suit on and the little watch. And it was amazing. Very few people died. Very few people got sick. He didn't have all the technology like we have today. He treated my arm when I had a very bad sprain, you know, but he was a person you could feel comfortable going to. And by him being the only doctor, that made it a lot easier. But he had that, I think what you call that agape love. But you could always smell a little tad bit of alcohol on his breath. But he healed everyone and took care of everyone. That was before the hospital, you know. The hospital was built. So then going into high school, we were aware that the schools were separated. And we were aware, as I'm sure many people have told you, persons have told you, that we were using hand-me-down books because everybody knew everybody's name. We knew all the whites' last names and the black last names, you know, and then when you look in your book, which, you know, names, we saw names that we knew were not black names, so we knew the books were hand-me-downs. And
were the desks hand-me-downs also?
They were. You can tell the difference between something new and something that's not. But we took advantage of what we had, you know. The thing that problemed me so much back then was the fact that black history was not taught.
Even in the black schools?
No, it was not taught. Based on the system, superintendent and all of that, it's a certain curriculum that had to be taught.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all about American history. And with me having, I'm very proud of my Native American heritage. And when I think about, we had one movie called The Hollywood Bead, and that was what was happening. You had to be there on Friday or Saturday night. If you didn't go to the movie on Friday or Saturday night, you would just doubt of it, you know, that it was located right there across from, you know, where the bicycle shop is.
Yes.
Yeah, right in that area there. And
near Crook's Corner?
Mm-hmm. Well, it was before there. It was, in, you know, where you're going into Carver,
mm-hmm,
and Rosemary. It's right here on the left of Main Street. Right across from where that church, you know, where that young man committed suicide, it was right across from there. Domino's, it was over in this area, past St. Paul Methodist Church.
On the right as you're going toward Carver.
On the right, yeah, going into Carver.
Where there's an auto shop now?
Mm-hmm. See, I'm not familiar with all the stores because I very rarely go up there now.
I think that's what it is.
So anyway, we would see movies and westerns and we would cheer for the Indians to be killed. I know, we would just say, kill them, kill them.
Oh, for them to be killed?
Oh. Yeah, you know, we were always, the Indians were the bad guys.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
And I think about all the movies I sat in and just stood up there and, oh, you know, because they were bad guys, oh, savages and all like that. And later, learning more about the Native American Indians, you know, you understand, that was sort of mind-boggling for me. There were no black courses taught. Everything was about the Constitution, you know, and this and that and this and that. And what I did later on when my children were small, I bought all the black, you know, books, history books that I could get. And I taught my own children a lot about black history. They were well versed on that. It's sad, but you know, it was just like what I think it is, you know, I think it's that the blacks, when you think about discrimination and all that, and people going in your back door, you couldn't let them come in your front door, and this and that. If I trusted someone to cook my food, prepare my meals, I certainly would not want someone to prepare my meals who I didn't feel to sit beside me. You know what I mean? That kind of thing. And then I've often thought about, and I guess I'm going back very far, with a lot of times on the plantations, the mothers who let the, there was always a big, like they call a big mammy on each plantation that had children, and she always had plenty of milk, you know, and they would let their babies nurse. Yeah, I just had problems with that, you know, because when you talk about discrimination, it's very mind-boggling even now, because I'm sure you're aware we still have subtle racism.
You look very pained right now.
Oh, yes, because, I've had to deal with it two ways, that of being a person of color and then that of being a disabled person. And it's the same in a lot of ways, except that when I attend meetings, I see black, I see white, I see rich, I see poor, you know what I mean, because disability has no special face. But we're all now dealing with the situation of discrimination because we're different. Not with color, but we're different, you see. To the point that a lot of people, if they can hide their disability, choose to do that because they don't want to be treated different. And I became a passionate advocate for disabled persons when I left my job, because when I looked out in the community and saw how disabled persons were treated, you know, and I know for a fact you're treated differently because I've lived that life. And I could advocate for a lot of people, and I still do that. And in 1991, I was appointed by the county commissioners to represent all the disabled persons in Orange County with the National Organization on Disability in Washington, D.C. And them having just passed the ADA, it gave you more empowerment.
Americans for Disability Act?
Mm-hmm, the ADA. Mm-hmm. And that is the second most valuable piece of legislation that's been passed other than the Civil Rights Bill. And neither one should have had to be passed. You understand?
Should have been done voluntarily, is that what you're saying?
Well, people should always have been, just like Martin Luther King said, I had the honor of meeting him. He came here and visited. I don't know if Ed was there. I think he was. This was a few years before he was killed at Hargraves, because that was the focal meeting point for all the blacks in the community. Hargraves, which is named after, I know you've heard about it.
Billy
it was named
Hargraves.
After Billy Hargraves, Mrs. Frances Hargraves' son. That was the focal meeting place. The context of a person's what the person is about, the context. You know, you don't judge a person because of the color of their skin, but the context of their character. And I've taught my children that, and that's the way I look at it. I've always looked at life as being, we all are people, persons. Excuse me, you're going to turn it off again. Many things, I've got to do some books, I have got to.
We didn't talk about your mother and father. Now, you said that you lived in Carver in a two-story home,
mm-hmm.
and your
grandparents, my mom's family.
And mm-hmm. were your mother and father living in the same house?
No. You see, what happened was, years ago, blindness was looked at as a curse. You know, as a curse. It had to have been hard for persons with disabilities mm-hmm. back then. You know, people were put in circuses and all that. And from what I was told is that this is something because of my sister's wishes, Mary Jones, you know, sort of private. I'm just sharing this with you. My mom and my father, that was a love made in heaven. But my grandparents would not allow them to be together because he was visually impaired. And since it was a genetic problem, you know, seeing it in his father had it, his grandfather had it, and all of that. So he couldn't work. And oh boy, my grandfather believed in working. You take care of your family. And I'm assuming that's the reason that he made her stay at home with them. You know what I mean? And it was a very unhappy situation.
So where did your mother and father live?
Well, they, from what I could get out of it, was that, and this is just confidential between
you
and I don't mind.
You don't want it on the tape?
No, not the grandparents yet, because my sister's very...
So who lived at home with your...
My grandparents.
Grandmother and grandfather?
Oh, that's when family lived together. My grandparents lived there, a distant cousin. My uncles, you know, it was a big two-story
all lived in the
house.
Same house.
Oh, back then.
And your mother
what,
also?
Yeah, my mom stayed there too. And when my uncles and all, they went off to war, she had to take care of them, you know, but it was a big house. That was when families stayed together. Mm-hmm. Families are not, it's not like that now. People rented out rooms. There was trust, you know, but now we don't have that. You know,
was the house painted?
My grandfather moved here. They moved here from Chatham County and bought that house. It was built and never painted. You know, they just built it and he purchased it, but it was never painted. It was never painted.
Did you have an outhouse?
No, we had a bathroom on the back porch.
Mm-hmm.
On the back porch. And my grandmother... she was about 100 pounds, about 5 foot tall, and that nose that looked like it was peaked, you know, and long black hair, and she had a pot in the backyard, and all the neighbors would chip in and bring grease and this and that and this and that, and I don't know what the components were, but she would make that soap called lye soap,
mm-hmm.
and she'd have a kettle in the backyard, and she, I was like stirring her brew, you know, and
right.
and she would stir it with the heat underneath and cook it and cook it, and then she would let it dry, and then she would cut it into blocks, share some with the neighbors, and that's what she used to do washing clothes, you know, for persons, and we bathed with that soap. I don't know what ingredients.
Did you have running water in the house?
Yes, we did.
And did you have something to heat the water?
Well, we didn't have the hot water, we had the cold water. And you had, Saturday night was bath night, you know, so we had put the kettles on the stove, you know, and we had a wooden cold stove. And,
so you didn't have central heat?
We had a wooden cold stove, and then we had the ice boxes back then,
mm-hmm.
They had an ice house, and I remember getting the wagon going up or getting a chunk of ice, and you put it in the top of the, it was like an opening in the top that you could close, and you could put the meat around it, and down below the little sheds, you know, and that's why they call it ice box, And some people did have refrigerators and some people didn't. But see, we didn't think about anything like that then.
Did you have electricity?
Oh, yes, we had electricity. And I remember the blackouts that were very scary.
In the 1940s,
oh,
World War II.
Oh, yes, the blackouts. And it was just like the fire drills in school. You never knew when there was a river. We didn't have the technology to detect planes coming over, so they would drop, you know, bombs wherever they saw lights. And so we had to, you'd hear the siren in the warning, and you had to douse everything, the fire in the stove, the lights, everything had to be darkened out. And my grandmother would sit there and say, shh, don't say anything, you know. And we never knew whether it was for real or not. As a matter of fact, you see the railroad tracks there. In Carver. Let's see, after you pass the Art Center, there's a set of tracks, you know, and back over there's a building that used to be called Comprehensive Health, and Moses Carey is the director. Now it's called the Carver Health Center, I think. But that building there was used, it was a big building used to build bombs. And like at Carmel Mall, it was a mill. Where they made materials and things, and the train would come through, load up, you know, and it was just a totally different town. Howard Lee found when he was mayor, was out in California and found a movie. I don't know how he stumbled across it about Chapel Hill years ago. Some people were coming through here going to Hollywood, and they camcordered a lot of the, we only had one taxi driver in Chapel Hill, no buses. Mr. James and his wife is still living, and his daughter, they live up on, right across, on Robertson Street, right across, right above Chapel Hill Tire Company. And he was the taxi driver, and it just showed the town way back then. And when the school was located on Merritt Mill Road, as Ed indicated in that article.
I wanted to go back and ask you more about your house. Was the house insulated?
No, I don't think so, because we had a wood, and we used wood and we used coal. And once, we had a fireplace in our living room, but we never used it. But in the room my sister and I slept in, you know, it was a fireplace, and it's just a regular stove. You had to put kindling and get the fire going, and when the fire went out, boy, it was cold. It was cold.
Where was the wood burning stove?
I don't know what happened to them, but
where did you keep it? In the kitchen? In the
well, we had a stove in the kitchen, and it had an oven, and it had a place on the top where you could put the wood, you know, whatever to cook, you know, so. And you could still bake biscuits and all the delicious biscuits baked in the oven. And then it was the top part, too.
Was that your sole source of heat?
No, we had like a wooden coal stove
in the bedroom.
And then we had, that usually heated up pretty much of the house. And then my uncle had gotten was it a gas stove or something? You know, I think they were out there then. But we started out with the wooden coal stove. And when we moved in 1950, I think it was 1954, we moved to a place my mom and I, brother and I, my sister was going off to college. She was in college then in 1954. We had an oil stove, you know, where you had the tank on the outside. Mm-hmm. You had to purchase the oil. And we had that then.
You didn't have a vent in your room, though, did you?
Oh, no, we didn't have the... No.
So your bedroom would get cold at
night?
Oh,
boy, my grandmother made some of the most warm
quilts.
Oh, yeah, because, you know, it was funny. You could stick your head out from under the cover and go, And it was just like being outside. You put a glass of water beside your bed and wake up the next morning, it was ice. So you just stayed under that blanket until you got a nice hot. I don't know what my sister told you about growing up, Mary Jones, you know, growing up about the history there, you know. But, you know, it's just like I was talking to this white gentleman in Harris Teeter, and he was talking about he grew up upstate somewhere and how they had so much poverty, 13 or 12 children. But he said no one felt poor. Isn't that something? Poverty, and that was not a thing that we ate well. You know what I'm saying?
You didn't feel poor, huh?
I'm sorry?
Are you saying you didn't feel poor?
No, I know I felt poor. I know that sometimes I wish that we had a bathroom like some of my friends, you know. Some of them had bathrooms. And they had, I assume that a heating facility. Then some people had outhouses. But they were all my friends. I didn't look at them as being less. You understand? They were my friends.
They were equal, even if they had more.
We all felt pretty much, at least I did, you know, because I always looked at people as being like the same. You know what I mean? You didn't understand all the reasons why things were this way, that way, this way, that way, the discrimination, and it was scary. But because we had such a close nucleus with if we did something wrong, we were punished by the principal, teacher. Then when we got home, we had to deal with it again. Or if we did something and our neighbors saw us, you know, well, they would scold us and we respected them. And then when we got home, everybody felt, I had so many different mothers. You understand what I'm saying. And there was so much respect that was given then to parents and the older persons, you understand?
Sure.
It's just a whole different time, Bob, a whole different time.
Martha, let's talk about Orange County.
I wish you had told me about what you were going to ask me about so I could kind of put down some notes, because this is...
You're doing fine. You're doing just fine. I wonder if you could tell me about what it was like at Orange County Training School. You started to mention Jim Notorium, and I interrupted you before, so let's go back to Orange County Training School, and then after that we'll move on to Lincoln.
Okay. At Orange County Training School, that's where I started. I went to school there, grades. It housed grades 1 through 12, Orange County Training School. It was not a high school or an elementary school. It just housed all the students. Now, in the document I gave you there that Ed did, he went back before OCTS was built. I think I can't remember when OCTS was built. But
1917.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, OCTS, we had, oh boy, the front part of the school, as you saw in the picture where the students were standing in front of the steps and it seemed like a porch there.
Well, actually it was built in 2024, I believe.
They found Steve Edwards, I wish he was still living, Steve Atwater, Henry Atwater, he could tell you so much. He found the, because he was a brick mason, he found the
stone?
Mm-hmm.
The original stone?
The cornerstone being
shown
to someone. It was in the area where, I think where social services was, either that little bathroom or that little area on the left, you know, kind of. But anyway, the gymtorium was there. We had the basketball court, and then the stage, and then all around the sides were classrooms for the elementary students.
All around the gymtorium.
Mm-hmm. Were classrooms.
Did it go by progression? First grade, second grade.
First grade classes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were centered around the gymtorium. We used up all our activities, you know, like PE and stuff when you didn't go outside. My sister was captain of the basketball team for several years. We had a very good team. When we competed, we always got very high, you know, like A's. These were the A's, the band, the college drama. I was very much interested in dramatics. And we did many plays, and we were very well known for Hillside High School in Durham and Orange County Training School. It has been forever, just like Duke in Carolina. With competition, you could not let Hillside beat us. Hillside could not let us beat them. You know, we played them with the same
intensity.
Oh yes, that Carolina and Duke played with. So, as I'm sure some others have told you, when we went to other schools, they were Hillside High. There was high school. There was in training school back then. Those were schools for persons with disciplinary problems, you know, whatever. And it was a little awkward and embarrassing.
But you didn't have that. I mean, you had the name training school, but you weren't.
We were not a training
school. A reform
school. No. But it was OC. That's why we usually said OCTS rather than Orange County Training School. You know, OCTS, that's our name. And so the parents, the PTA, Muriel McCauley's mom is president, PTA. The parents and students, we all got together and they petitioned the superintendent in Raleigh to change the name because it was like stereotyping students. It was embarrassing. Oh, this is Orange County Training School, you know, when they did have training schools out there. So, but this was a legitimate school. So they changed it. I think they changed the name. My sister, she remembers everything. They changed it in, I think, 1947. I'm not sure if that's the correct date. 48, close. And however, it became Lincoln High School. And so I'm assuming that then that's when the students, see, we still had students there from 1 through 12. Because we were still at OCTS. The name was changed to Lincoln. And so then the procedure began to build a high school. You know, so they built Lincoln. And I think, it opened its doors in September of 1951. And so the students left Orange County Training School, the high school students, and went to Lincoln. That was just grades 9 through 12. And we left the grades.